all right, decisions. Boy, there's been a whole hell of a lot of decisions to be made around here today. Everywhere. Even whether or not I'm going to wear these glasses because it's getting all foggy over here, all right? That's what's happening. Anyway, welcome to the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm desperately trying to get out from under a hat, okay? But now it's all safe. This is an extremely important time in basically in what's happening in the world, what's happening in this country, and what's happening right here. And I'm really, really anxious and pleased to be part of digging into figuring out what the hell is going on and what are we going to do about it? How are we going to change things? Are we going to end up sitting here like this? Are we going to end up just pretending? Or even if we're trying, but not trying as much as we need to be and not trying to figure out the ways that we need to, what we need to do to actually change things and to make this world a place that's, you know, basically it's a place that can be inhabited by people, animals, all kinds of, you know, everything. And we have to understand what's going on and what's not going on. And that's part of what we're here for. That's part of what the station is here for. That's part of what we're here for, what the Michael Slate Show is about. And this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. In case I forgot to tell you that, this is the 4th of July special. And I'm inviting all of you listening to imagine a world without America, all right? Imagine a world without America. Whoa, yeah. Even saying that, you kind of feel this lift that comes up where people are saying, where people are beginning to understand what's happening and why, all right? At the back end of the show, we'll be hearing an interview I did almost exactly 6 years ago with Ed Baptist, who's the author of The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. Now, he'll be talking about why forgiveness by the oppressed can never erase the horror of 400 years of barbaric torture and murder. Before that, we'll hear actor Keith David reading the famous speech by Frederick Douglass. And it's a very heavy speech, and people need to hear this again and again and again. Okay, it's what to the slave is your 4th of July? What to the slave is your 4th of July? What can you say about that? Well, when you're through with this, you'll be rethinking some things. All right. And as a way of introducing that speech, we're going to hear Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on what to the slave is your 4th of July, from the past to the present, okay? And it's a clip from Revolution, why it's necessary, why it's possible, and what it's all about. A film of a talk by B.A. given in 2003. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased about this. I'm going to read Bob Avakian, a necessary and fitting commentary on July 4th, which I recorded just yesterday.
A necessary and fitting commentary on July 4th by Bob Avakian. And this was done in July 3rd, 2020, and it's part of RevCom.us. Any country which began with its foundation in slavery and genocide against the native peoples, which maintained and expanded slavery on land stolen from native peoples in Mexico for nearly 100 years after its founding, which for another 100 years after the Civil War carried out thousands of lynchings of black people with mass celebrations of this, including the selling of postcards of lynchings throughout the country, which still has thousands of monuments to the Confederacy and white supremacy, and which today continues racist oppression in every dimension of society, enforced by continuing police terror, any such country has absolutely no claim to any positive celebration of itself or its history and heritage. That's from Bob Avakian, B.A., and he's the most important political thinker and leader in the world today.
All right. Once again, that was Bob Avakian. And, you know, folks, this stuff that we're playing today is stuff that you need to actually think about. You need to think about, maybe figure out where you can go and get it after the show's over. Think about these things. Think about the difference it makes in all this, okay? This is an incredibly important this whole show today. It's incredibly important for what's happening in the world and what needs to happen as well. Now, there's going to be a little bit more from Bob Avakian, which I think is actually very important as well, and part of the whole theme that we're running with today. All right, I want you to hear Bob Avakian doing "What to the Slave Is Your 4th of July?" from the past to the present. Now, it's a clip taken from Revolution: Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, What It's All About. A film of a talk by Bob Avakian given in 2003 in the U.S. All right, so check this out.
Frederick Douglass was a slave himself, who after he got his own freedom, spent his life fighting against the oppression of black people and other injustices. Invited to speak at a July 4th celebration, Douglass made clear that July 4th was nothing to celebrate and that America was guilty of great crimes. Here's what he said about it. What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him, more than all other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty and unholy license, your national greatness, swelling vanity, your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants are brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgiving, with all your parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes that would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of the United States at this very hour. And Douglass also said, America may accuse others of savagery, but really it has no equal when it comes to this. He said, for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival. As the saying goes, truer words were never spoken. Douglass spoke these words while slavery still legally existed in the United States, but his comments apply just as much even after outright slavery was ended. And all this time, while all these lynchings and other acts of incredible cruelty were being carried out, with all the oppression they embodied and enforced, all this time, those who ruled this country, those who refused to do anything to stop these lynchings and other acts of terror and atrocities, those who were responsible for these and other barbaric crimes, all this time, they never stopped proclaiming, this is the greatest country in the world. This is the greatest country that has ever been. This is the leader of the free world. This is the homeland of freedom and democracy. It is not just that many white people acted like depraved beasts. And it is not that some were actually devils, although it certainly may have seemed that way many times in the history of this country. The deeper thing is that all these horrors were shaped by, they were encouraged by, and they served to keep in effect a whole system, a system that could not have existed without first slavery and then near slavery. And segregation and terror centered in the South while the great majority of black people lived there, chained in one way or another to the rural South and on white-owned plantations. White supremacy is built into the foundation of this country. It is something this system and those who rule it could not do without, even if they wanted to, which they don't. And this has continued down to the present. Despite all the false claims these days about how this is now a colorblind society, segregation and discrimination continue against black people and other people of color. Every time there is a study or a survey to determine this, it shows without fail that segregation and discrimination exist in housing, in jobs, in schools, in healthcare, in every part of society. And this continues to be backed up with brutality and violence.
All right, continues to be backed up. Think about that. Now let's, now I want to, actually, there's something I actually want to, I think this is what I want to do is, that was Bob Avakian, as I said, what to the slave is your 4th of July. And, that's from the past to the present, as he says. Now, I want to actually give you a chance to hear a speech from Frederick Douglass. I went and it's being read by the actor Keith David on this show. It was read by him a few years ago, actually. I think it was one of the first times that he had actually read this, and he was just like really, he was excited to do it. He was also a little worried about what people would be thinking about it. And people really loved it. They thought it captured a lot of what was going on. So now, let's hear the whole speech that Frederick Douglass gave. And it's being read by actor Keith David. And I'm telling you, this is going to knock your socks off, right? This is something you don't want to forget. All right? So check this out.
Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon here to speak today? What have I or those I represent to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I therefore called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? Would to God, for both your sakes and ours, that an affirmative answer could be truthfully returned to these questions. Then would my task be light, and my burden easy and delightful. For who is there so cold that a nation's sympathy could not warm him? Who so obdurate and dead to the claims of gratitude that would not thankfully acknowledge such priceless benefits? Who so stolid and selfish that would not give his voice to swell the hallelujahs of a nation's jubilee when the chains of servitude had been torn from his limbs? I am not that man. In a case like that, the dumb might eloquently speak, and the lame man leap as an hart. But such is not the state of the case. I say it with a sad sense of the disparity between us. I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join in your joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? If so, there is a parallel to your conduct, and let me warn you that it is dangerous to copy the example of a nation whose crimes, lowering up to heaven, were thrown down by the breath of the Almighty, burying that nation in irrecoverable ruin. I can today take up the plaintive lament of a peeled and woe-smitten people. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. For there, they that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they who wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. Fellow citizens, above your national tumultuous joy, I hear the mournful wail of millions whose chains heavy and grievous yesterday, are today rendered more intolerable by the jubilee shouts that reach them. If I do forget, if I do not faithfully remember those bleeding children of sorrow this day, may my right hand forget her cunning, and may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. To forget them, to pass lightly over their wrongs, and to chime in with the popular theme, would be treason most scandalous and shocking, and would make me a reproach before God and the world. My subject, then, fellow citizens, is American slavery. I shall see this day and its popular characteristics from the slave's point of view. Standing there, identified with the American bondman making his wrongs mine, I do not hesitate to declare with all my soul that the character and conduct of this nation never looked blacker to me than on this 4th of July. Whether we turn to the declarations of the past or to the professions of the present, the conduct of the nation seems equally hideous and revolting. America is false to the past, false to the present, and solemnly binds herself to be false to the future. Standing with God and with the crushed and bleeding slave on this occasion, I will, in the name of humanity, which is outraged, in the name of liberty, which is fettered, in the name of the Constitution and the Bible, which are disregarded and trampled upon, dare to call in question and to denounce with all the emphasis I can command everything that serves to perpetuate slavery, the great sin and shame of America. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will use the severest language I can command, and yet not one word shall escape me that any man whose judgment is not blinded by prejudice, or who is not at heart a slaveholder, shall not confess to be right and just. But I fancy I hear some of my audience say, it is just in this circumstance that you and your brother abolitionists fail to make a favorable impression on the public mind. Would you argue more and denounce less? Would you persuade more and rebuke less? Your cause would be much more likely to succeed. But I submit, where all is plain, there is nothing to be argued. What point in the anti-slavery creed would you have me argue? On what branch of the subject do the people of this country need light? Must I undertake to prove that the slave is a man? That point is conceded already. Nobody doubts it. The slaveholders themselves acknowledge it in the enactment of laws for their government. They acknowledge it when they punish disobedience on the part of the slave. There are 72 crimes in the state of Virginia, which, if committed by a black man, no matter how ignorant he be, subject him to the punishment of death, while only 2 of the same crimes will subject a white man to the like punishment. What is this but the acknowledgement that the slave is a moral, intellectual, and responsible being? The manhood of the slave is conceded. It is admitted in the fact that Southern statute books are covered with enactments forbidding, under severe fines and penalties, the teaching of the slave to read or to write. When you can point to any such laws in reference to the beasts of the field, then may I consent to argue the manhood of the slave. When the dogs in your streets, when the fowls of the air, when the cattle on your hills, when the fish of the sea and the reptiles that crawl shall be unable to distinguish the slave from a brute, there will I argue with you that the slave is a man. For the present, it is enough to affirm the equal manhood of the Negro race. Is it not astonishing that while we are plowing and planting, reaping, using all kinds of mechanical tools, erecting houses, constructing bridges, building ships, working in metals of brass, iron, copper, silver, and gold, that while we are reading, writing, and ciphering, acting as clerks, merchants, and secretaries, having among us lawyers, doctors, ministers, poets, authors, editors, orators, and teachers, that while we are engaged in all manner of enterprises common to other men, digging in gold in California, capturing the whale in the Pacific, feeding sheep and cattle on the hillside, living, moving, acting, thinking, planning, living in families as husbands, wives, and children, and above all, confessing and worshiping the Christian's God and looking hopefully for life and immortality beyond the grave, we are called upon to prove that we are men. Would you have me argue that man is entitled to liberty? That he is the rightful owner of his own body? That you have already declared it. Must I argue the wrongfulness of slavery? Is that a question for Republicans? Is it to be settled by the rules of logic and argumentation as a matter beset with great difficulty, involving a doubtful application of the principle of justice, hard to be understood? How should I look today in the presence of Americans, dividing and subdividing a discourse to show that men have a natural right to freedom, speaking of it relatively and positively, negatively and affirmatively? To do so would be to make myself ridiculous and to offer an insult to your understanding. There is not a man beneath the canopy of heaven that does not know that slavery is wrong for him. What, am I to argue that it is wrong to make men brutes? To rob them of their liberty? To work them without wages? To keep them ignorant of their relations to their fellow men? To beat them with sticks? To flay their flesh with the lash? To load their limbs with irons? To hunt them with dogs? To sell them at auction? To sunder their families? To knock out their teeth? To burn their flesh, to starve them into obedience and submission to their masters? Must I argue that a system thus marked with blood and stained with pollution is wrong? No, I will not. I have better employments for my time and strength than such arguments would imply. What then remains to be argued? Is it that slavery is not divine, that God did not establish it, that our doctors of divinity are mistaken? There is blasphemy in the thought. That which is inhuman cannot be divine. Who can reason on such a proposition? They that can may, I cannot. The time for such argument is past. At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument, is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour out a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, and the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed. And its crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced. What, to the American slave, is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim. To him, Your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty, an unholy license. Your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation on earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour. Go where you may, search where you will, roam through all the monarchies and despotisms of the old world, travel through South America, search out every abuse, and when you have found the last, lay your facts by the side of the everyday practices of this nation, and you will say with me that for revolting barbarity and shameless hypocrisy, America reigns without a rival.
America reigns without a rival. I remember the first time I heard that. It was in this studio, actually. And I was just really stunned by it. And we had Keith David on to read it. And it just gets stronger and stronger every time you hear it. And if you listen to it and you aren't stunned by what's happening, by what's being said there, and looking at what's happening in the world today, in this country, in the world today, if you're not stunned by that, there's something wrong with you. All right? So that was Keith David in a really stunning reading of What to the Slave is Your 4th of July. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
A poem for Jose Campos Torres. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I had confessed to myself all along, chaser of life, poetry, trends, that awareness, consciousness, poems that screamed of pain and the origins of pain and death had blanketed my tablets, and therefore my friends, brothers, sisters, in-laws, outlaws, and besides, they already knew. But Brother Torres, common ancient bloodline Brother Torres, is dead. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I had said I wasn't going to write no more words down about people kicking us when we're down, about racist dogs that attack us and drive us down, drag us down, and beat us down. But the dogs are in the street. The dogs are alive, and the terror in our hearts has scarcely diminished. It has scarcely brought us the comfort we suspected. The recognition of our terror and the screaming release of that recognition has not removed the certainty of that knowledge. How could it? The dogs, rabid, foaming with the energy of their brutish ignorance, stride the city streets like robot gunslingers and spread death as night lamps flash crude reflections from gun butts and police shields. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. But the battlefield has oozed away from the stilted debates of semantics, beyond the questionable flexibility of primal screaming. The reality of our city, jungle streets and their Gestapos has become an attack on home, life, family, philosophy, total. It is beyond a question of the advantages of didactic niggerisms. The dogs are in the street. In Houston, maybe someone said Mexicans were the new niggers. In L.A., maybe someone said Chicanos were the new niggers. In Frisco, maybe someone said Orientals were the new niggers. Maybe in Philadelphia and North Carolina, they decided they didn't need no new niggers. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this, but the dogs are in the street. It's a turnaround world where things are all too quickly turned around. It was turned around so that right looked wrong. It was turned around so that up looked down. It was turned around so that those who marched in the street with Bibles and signs of peace became enemies of the state and risk to national security, so that those who questioned the operations of those in authority on the principles of justice, liberty, and equality became the vanguard of a communist attack. It became so you couldn't call a spade a spade. Brother Torres is dead. The Wilmington 10 are still incarcerated. Ed Davis, Ronald Reagan, James Hunt, and Frank Rizzo are still alive, and the dogs are in the street. I had said I wasn't going to write no more poems like this. I made a mistake.
He made a mistake saying he wasn't going to write no more poems like that, but he didn't make any other mistake in his life because he reached out to people. If you weren't moved by listening to Gil Scott and what he was talking about here, something's wrong, okay? It's something that was a very, very heavy piece, and it was something that I know moved me like crazy. When I was first starting to do this show, again, this is one of the times that I remember in the earliest days, like maybe the first couple of months that I was doing this, think about Keith David, and Gil Scott, you know, playing what they were saying, talking to them about what they saw in the world, and thinking about what's going on now, what's happening now. You know, this is an incredible time that we're facing. It's a time full of great danger, but it's also a time that could be ripe with people who begin to understand what's happening and why and what can be done about it. That's the kind of thing that needs to ripen, okay? That's what really needs to ripen. And I'd say people need to pay attention to that, because we can't keep going on just repeating and repeating the kinds of beautiful, heavy songs, heavy and beautiful that they are. But they should be helping us understand what needs to be done and what we need to do. You think about that. This is the kind of thing that this station, that this show, I'm not going to speak for the whole station. I'm going to speak for this show. You know, and I come in here and I look at the people that are helping me do this. I look at Kiana, I look at Henry. And, you know, you folks are actually, you're looking at this. You're looking at this, and this is the, you know what a difference it makes to hear the truth about something. You know what a difference it makes for people to actually get up and do something. Get up and just fight for the truth, damn it. Fight for the truth. And you know what? People need to start not just saying, yeah, I got that. I got it. I'm good, because you're not good if you're not doing, okay? That's a problem. And I'm not saying you got what you got to do, but you got to be doing something that makes a point that helps move things forward to the possibility of a whole other world, a whole other place where people can live, where children can play and not worry about the kind of hellhole that they're in now, where people in countries and I've been in these countries, where people were laying on the ground, trying to get water from a puddle. And they hadn't had a drink of water in a very long time, or kids that you could count every bone in their body. And yet they still had a laugh. They had a laugh, okay? And, this is the kind of thing that what made me go into the station was just being able to present this kind of stuff. And I hadn't thought about these for a long time. I hadn't thought about the songs that we did with these folks and the things we brought into it. And it was really, really important, and it remains important today. And I am going to move on, but I want people to know, check out my social media and check out the RevComs. Find out what's up and get involved, okay? That's what the people need to find out what's up and get involved. Find out what's up, all right? And then you can make your decision about what you're going to do, okay? And I think it's that, you know, you can't look at the world today. Everybody's talking about Biden's this, Biden's that. Well, you know, Biden is one of them. Okay, let's just be real, all right? Biden is one of them, and it's you know, yeah, he's not Trump, that's for damn sure. And there are Nazis, fascists standing up, and, you know, going up against it with the various Democrats and the people behind them. But we got a whole other agenda on our plate. You know, we got a whole other way of dealing with stuff, and this is what people need to begin to start really seriously. What is it? What is it that we have to do to make the world change? All right. Now, okay, I want to bring this back to what we're doing. Now, we're going to hear the interview, this interview that I did with Ed Baptist, author of The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. That's right. The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. He is peeking out after the 2015 Charleston Massacre, the murder of nine African-American parishioners during a Bible study at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church. Boy, that's a mouthful. Okay. This is a church, a very important church. Again, it's the, he's doing a Bible study at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church. This is a church which played a significant role in the civil rights movement. The murders were carried out by a white supremacist in direct response to the church's support for civil rights. So take a listen to this. It's extremely important. Don't get up and run around. Let your heart open up. Let your head open up. Check it out. Joining us now to continue this conversation is Edward Baptist. And Edward is the author of the book, The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism.
Edward, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be back.
You got that voice again, man. I need your voice. Give it to me. Yeah, well, it's great to have you back, and I want to have you back a lot more, but I also was moved to have you back because you wrote an editorial piece that just knocked my socks off, and I think it's extremely important that people look at this, and especially as we've been talking about the entire show, this kind of slaughter, this kind of heinous crimes committed against people of color in this country. And you're the title of your op-ed piece was Forgiveness in Charleston Isn't Absolution for 400 Years of Racial Violence in America. Give people a sense of what you were talking about there.
Well, I got the sense, and a lot of other people did as well, that the victims' families' willingness to step forward and tell Dylann Roof that they forgave him, which I think was part of their own process and really their own really a private process in a way, even though it was done in public, that it gave too many people the sense in this country that we didn't really have to confront the causes, the wider societal causes that lead to the kind of violence that we saw in Charleston last week. So I didn't want to participate in letting people off the hook, letting me off the hook, letting anybody else off the hook for that. I think we need to confront the larger causes, the larger sorts of issues that, for instance, the Black Lives Matter movement is trying to confront.
Yeah, well, and what do you bring out? And I thought this was extremely important because there's only a few places that actually tackle it this way, where you actually put it in terms of you can't overcome basically centuries of dehumanization and murder, violence on which this entire system we live in is based on through reconciliation. And that's something I don't think people, you know, everybody always looks at, oh, well, peace and reconciliation in South Africa, reconciliation here, reconciliation there. But in every one of those cases, the crimes are just like pushed aside or whitewashed. And it's not what, you know, it doesn't really achieve anything for the people except somehow accepting the way things are.
Well, I think you have to change the realities, the social and economic and political realities that are the outcome of those 400 years. If you look at the case of South Africa, it's very problematic. I mean, you have the Truth and Reconciliation Committees, and we've never had something like that in this country or only on very limited scales. And yet, despite all the good work that the people who participated in that process have done, at the end of the day, there's a shift in political power to the majority, but economic power remains with the white minority in South Africa. There's simply a huge amount of social conflict because of that fact, because you've still got these massive kind of inequities. And we've got inequities that in their own way are parallel to that here. And we are simply not going to address them by saying, isn't it great that the victims' families have forgiven the killer? That's really a private process. That's them working through their grief. But if we want to do something that will help make it less likely that this sort of event will happen again or other sorts of events will happen again, we've got our own work that we have to do.
Now, you refer to something you call Walmart Grace. Tell me what that is.
Right. So that comes about from thinking a little bit, and again with the help of a lot of other people who are talking about this issue, about the concept of grace. And of course the victims' families are working with a concept of grace and forgiveness that comes from Christianity. Not surprisingly, the victims were members of the AME Church. And so that's the kind of language they're going to be speaking in. And working in that language, I thought back to some things I'd read in the distant past. And some other people were doing this too, I should point out, like the journalist Jamel Bowie. And what I thought back to was the writings of the German theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who criticized the idea of cheap grace. And there's a difference between free grace and cheap grace. Free grace is granted by God. It's not something that people really have any control over. But Bonhoeffer said, too often what we want is not free grace, which should demand a response on our part, but what we want is cheap grace, which is grace that comes without any rethinking of what we have done and what we are continuing to do, that puts us in the position of needing to be forgiven for something. And what's cheaper than Walmart?
Very good point. Having bought many things there, I know exactly what you're talking about. But, well, there's more to it, too, though, because, you know, also talk about this whole point of that this question of basically, we'll put it this way. You say, and it's that point you were just saying, my fellow white Americans, the killer remains at large and the killer is us. And that's something that is never spoken to in this kind of a situation.
Yeah, although the preacher from this past Sunday at Riverside Church, Reverend Barber did that. And he's got an op-ed out now that's, as I understand, basically the text of the sermon. And that's his, you know, that's his kind of hook. That's his line. The perpetrator was caught last Thursday, and yet the killer is still at large. And the killer is the set of attitudes that in this country ensures that on some level, black lives don't matter in the way that we run our society. Black lives too often don't matter when we think about how policing and criminal justice should take place in the society. They don't matter when we think about how mass incarceration works in this society, where you've got millions of people behind bars, disproportionate number of them black and brown. And it's as if the fact that large numbers of them may be innocent, they may be the victims of over-policing, they may be framed for their crimes, or they may be given these absurdly long sentences for their crimes. Their lives are being literally locked up, being spent locked up. And yet this doesn't matter to us as much as it should. So these kinds of attitudes cheapen the lives of African Americans in the views of our society and our culture far too often. Obviously, lots of people criticize those facts, criticize those attitudes. Many white people criticize those attitudes. But there's always more work that we need to do to actually combat those attitudes, combat those policies, and change those realities.
You know, one question I had, because of the book that you wrote, and which I told you when I interviewed you, it was one of the best books I've read in a very, very long time. But you actually showed how this whole question, the whole issue of slavery, the whole reality of slavery, and by extension, the whole reality of the continued slavery-based oppression and repression of black people in America, that this is actually, you know, this is something that was like really endemic to this system. And I think that's something that really has to be tackled when you're talking about getting behind the root cause of it, and how do you get beyond that? You know, you're dealing with something that is, as you said, 400 years of violence, but it's at the same time, this racist violence, at the same time, it's rooted in something and a system that required the most repulsive system in the history of humanity, the slave system, actually was used to build this, and it was part and parcel of this whole thing, of the foundation of it. That's a big thing to deal with in relation to all this.
Yeah, I mean, the words that supposedly Dylann Roof said when he was asked, you know, why are you doing this to us, when he was shooting people in the church basement, you know, he said, you're taking over our country, right? You are taking over our country, as if their ancestors had not probably been in this country longer than his, and you're raping our women. And first of all, most of the people he's shooting are women who are far older than him. I mean, it's absurd on the face of it. But what he's really talking about is a much deeper and wider belief, an anxiety about somehow black people are going to take over the country. You saw this after both of Obama's elections. You saw this surge of that sort of anxiety, and an anxiety about sexual violence. And you find both of those anxieties repeated again and again and again in the antebellum era, every time there's a scare about a slave rebellion. And we could talk to psychologists about the ways in which this is, you know, a kind of a transference of the guilt, maybe that some of the whites were actually doing those things to enslaved African Americans, that they're sort of projecting it on enslaved African Americans. And I'm sure there's something to that. But this sort of script of talking about the relationship between white and black America, that white America feels it has to police and fear black America, that starts in slavery, and it starts because of the nature of enslavement. And it's continued. You can watch it continue in the discussions about Reconstruction. You can watch it continue throughout the Jim Crow era. These anxieties are constantly called up every time that there's a lynching. And it continues through the Civil Rights era. So that discourse, if we can call it that, is deeply, deeply ingrained as a way that large numbers of white people in this country are encouraged to relate to African Americans collectively.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ed, we have about, a minute and a half, 2 minutes to go on this. I want you to talk about atonement, because you posed that at the very end of your piece, and this question of atonement and what you mean by that and why it's so important.
Well, I mean, atonement is a great big theological concept, and I'm not a theologian, but as I understand it, it means doing things maybe not to merit forgiveness, but to show that you intend to behave in ways that merit forgiveness. And this means taking risks, putting yourself in the place of those who have been wronged, those who you have wronged, whether individually or collectively, suffering with them, suffering in some sense for the sins that you have committed. And this could take all kinds of forms. I think that when whites take risks to participate in social movements that involve that are about African-American freedom, African-American liberation, in some cases, they're certainly taking real risks. Sometimes they might not be the same as the risks that African-Americans are taking, but they often are quite real risks. And sometimes this is also going to have to be about being quiet and listening to those who have been wronged, instead of trying to silence African-American voices, instead of being too fragile to hear about what has happened in the past, too fragile to hear about what has been the result of white violence and plunder over time, being strong enough to actually listen to and hear the voices that are talking about that, that could be a kind of atonement or the beginning of a process of atonement. And I think that that is what we need to turn towards instead of reacting to criticism, reacting to the events in such a way that in particular for whites, that they shut off or try to shut off discussion. That's simply futile, and it's destructive in its own right.
All right, Edward Baptist, we got to wrap it up right now because we're just running out of time.
Okay.
But really, thank you very much for joining us today, and look forward to having you back, all right?
All right, thanks for having me on.
Sure, take care now.
All right, that was Ed Baptist, author of The Half Has Never Been Told, a really brilliant book. It's The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism. Don't forget to get this one. It'll change a lot of what you think about, all right? You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Now, we're going to move on to hear BA on American Exceptionalism, Free Yourself from the GTF, all right? So check this out. This is an excerpt from a speech he gave in 2019, The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible. So let's hear it.
We are confronted by, we are now being ruled by, a fascist regime. In confronting and moving to prevent this, one of the biggest obstacles standing in the way and weighing people down is American chauvinism, the disgusting notion that America and Americans are better and more important than everybody else. This is a poison infecting people broadly in this country, even among the bitterly oppressed. And there is a great need for people to break with this American chauvinism. Free yourself from the GTF, the great tautological fallacy. A fallacy, an idea or way of thinking that is false, wrong. A tautology, a round in a circle way of reasoning that asserts something and then claims to prove it by merely asserting the same thing again. So the great tautological fallacy to which I am referring is the notion that America is a force for good in the world, and therefore whatever it does is good, or at least done with good intentions, even if the same thing, when done by other forces, especially by forces opposed to us, is bad, is evil, because America is a force for good in the world. Thus, in the grip of the great tautological fallacy, when one is told by the authorities and government and the media, etc., that North Korea developing a small number of nuclear weapons and a few long-range ballistic missiles poses a grave threat, one does not question. One does not ask why that is a grave threat, while the only country ever to use nuclear weapons, the United States, having thousands of nuclear weapons and the capability to use them anywhere in the world, is somehow not a grave threat.
All right. That was, that was refusing to accept a fascist America. I just got to say that again. We refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible. Now, we have something that we really want to play very eagerly to play this. Now we've got time for one more piece from Bob Avakian. And this one is brand new. This is Bob Avakian Weapons of Oppression, and The Heart to Fight to End Oppression. So let's give it a listen.
Weapons of Oppression and The Heart to Fight to End Oppression. This system has two big weapons it uses to maintain masses of people in a situation where they are oppressed, brutalized, degraded, and demoralized. The first weapon is the murderous armed force of this system, which, along with all its other atrocities, continually hunts down and kills Black, Brown, and Native American people in the most depraved ways. The second weapon is the way this system messes people up and gets them thinking and acting in messed up ways, and especially how this system denies the youth a decent future, forcibly confines so many in miserable conditions, and gets them caught up in fighting and killing each other. This, too, is a monstrous crime of this system. What kind of system condemns so many youth to nothing better than this? What kind of system does so many people this way and then seizes on what it has got people caught up in, uses this as an excuse to treat masses of people as less than human, murder them in the thousands, and lock them up in the millions right in this country, while it slaughters people all around the world and destroys the earth? It is this monstrous system of capitalism imperialism that we are now forced to live under, a system that could not survive without viciously exploiting billions of people worldwide, including more than 150 million children, a system that never will and never can stop doing all this. But it doesn't have to be this way. We RevComs are out to change all this, the only way it can be done, through an actual revolution to do away with this whole system. We have the science, the strategy and plan, and the leadership to do this. And we are actively working and waging the necessary struggle to bring forth and organize a revolutionary force of thousands and then millions from many different parts of society, and especially youth, whose anger, frustration, and desperation to make a mark in this world and be respected needs to be and can be transformed into determination to put an end to this system and to bring a radically different and much better world into being, to become emancipators of humanity. In a declaration, a call to get organized now for a real revolution, we have made it clear. This not only cries out to be done, it is possible. And everyone who has a heart to fight for something really worth fighting for needs to get with this revolution we are working for now.
All right, that was Bob Avakian with Weapons of Oppression and the Heart to Fight to End Oppression. Sisters and brothers, that is something that is absolutely just incredibly important. We have to have the heart to fight and end oppression. And if you're not going to do that, you're not going to be doing anything with your life. You're not going to be doing anything good with your life. And basically, the rest of humanity is going to pay the price. It's time that we stopped. It's time that we stopped allowing all this to go on without any real opposition to it. You know, there are people out there who are fighting, and we need people to actually step up and say, I'm not going to allow this to continue. You have to make the choice, sisters and brothers. You have to make the choice. There was a lot of stuff on here about the weapons of oppression and the heart to fight them. And there's a lot of other stuff on here about other aspects of things. Put them together. And it's going to make, and when you do put them together and you basically look at it and you step down and you decide where you're going to go, what you're going to do, then you're going to be able to step up and make a real difference in the world. All right. And I want to thank all the people who helped with the show today. I just want to say, who is it now? I want to say, I'm just going to make Henry beg. Anyway, Henry, you know, Henry Carson, you know, the show doesn't exist without you. And Kiana, I'm just so happy to see you every Friday morning when I get in here. And a shout out to Sergio coming up with the global, the global village. Can't forget that one. It's a beautiful show. All right. So I'm Michael Slate. Glad I'm here today. Talk to you again next week.
Set out to do. Stand.
There's a cross for you to bear.
Things to go through if you're going anywhere.
Things you want are real.
You have you to complete, and there is no deal. There's a permanent priest in your right and wrong. Stand.
There's a midget standing tall,
and the giant beside him about to fall.
Crawl,
and they know what you're saying makes sense at all.